This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Sweat dripping down, no relief in sight. This never-ending heat wave burning up the night.
Spring heat waves are all over. Millions of people are caught in the climate fire. Australian scientist Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick led an international team of scientists publishing their global overview paper, Terrestrial Heat in 2023. It's a terrible list. But it is not just climate. Huge natural systems are failing. From the University of Hawaii, Charles Fletcher is co-author of the heavily viewed new paper, Earth at Risk, An Urgent Call to End the Age of Destruction and Forge a Just and Sustainable Future. Toss in hot news of crazy weather flips, artificial intelligence catastrophe forecasts, failing ocean currents, and here you go, a full Radio Eco Show. Welcome, I'm Alex Smith.
Every breath I take is like a fire in my lungs. Feels like I'm walking through an inferno. It stings and stuns, mirage plays tricks on me. Oasis just a dream. Oasis just a dream.
As weatherman Scott Duncan says, April 2024 will go down as one of the most incredible flips on record in Europe. Summer to winter for some. Meanwhile, it was 39.2 degrees C, that's 106.6 Fahrenheit, in the shade in Turkey, and that spread all over Asia, all the way to China. The highest April temperature ever recorded in Turkey. North Africa was sizzling with Chad and Niger breaking national records for April, just as American forces move out and Russians move in. No wonder flimsy rafts full of Africans daring death are trying for Europe. And it's been incredibly hot again and again and again in South America. How hot was it? We begin with a scalding autopsy for 2023 heat waves around the world. In 2023, extreme heat waves rolled across Earth's surface so fast, and there were so many, who can remember them all? In some places, heat was up to 9 degrees C, or 16 Fahrenheit, hotter than normal. Summer-level heat waves struck in winter and again in spring, followed by simply astounding heat on every continent but Australia. 2023 wasn't just the hottest year ever recorded. It was a year when forests burned, cities cooked, and crops died. It was very uncomfortable. So let us patch together the heat headlines, including many you did not see. Our guest is Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick, and she led an international team of scientists publishing their global overview paper titled Extreme Terrestrial Heat in 2023. Dr. Perkins Kirkpatrick is with the Fenner School of Environment and Society at Australian National University in Canberra, and also the ARC Centre of Excellence for 21st Century Weather, also at ANU. So from Canberra, Australia, Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Okay, so heat records tend to be splattered all over the place in local and national records. Was it difficult to find the portrait of 2023 of heat around the world?
Pretty phenomenal year. Pretty much every continent had these record-breaking or near-record-breaking heat waves. As you said in your introduction, basically the only place that didn't have continuous or really intense heat waves was Australia, where I'm from. That's not to say we didn't have a hot year here. It was reasonably hot. It was just hotter overall. We didn't have those record-breaking. But basically everywhere else in the world had multiple relentless heat waves almost throughout the year. And we simply couldn't cover them all. We had so many that we could choose from, and it was a matter of just choosing the ones that either we had the most data on or had the worst impacts or were just the worst overall.
And your report highlights extreme heat in four continental areas. Let us start with South America, which I think is so badly neglected in the Northern Hemisphere mass media. We might expect 10 or 20 days of unheard-of oppressive heat. But tell us what people in parts of South America experienced in the...
Absolutely. I would even add to that that I was even shocked to see what happened in South America. And it didn't even receive much attention in other parts of the Southern Hemisphere either. But basically there is that they had heat waves occur in their normally colder parts of the year. So think coming into spring or even at the end of winter, they had some record-breaking events. And during those times of the year, temperatures were what you would expect to see in high summer. They were record-breaking even for a summer heat wave. And they were just so severe, they covered large parts of both the southeast of South America and even central South America as well. South America has an interesting climate. Parts of Bolivia, for example, can get quite hot towards the end of the calendar winter. But even then, what was seen there was quite exceptional. And it just didn't stop. It started around August, which is the winter in the southern hemisphere, and just kept on going for the rest of the year. And then we had, during summer in South America, we had heat coupled with high humidity, which, you know, resulted in some deaths as well.
Is it South America that experienced at least 130 days of basically a heat wave? Almost a third of a year was just one big heat wave?
So, yes, it was northern South America. So when we're looking, my geography of where countries lie in South America isn't ideal, but certainly in the, you know, the central to northern parts of South America, around somewhere in the Amazon basin, they had a lot of heat wave days. So we're looking at something between maybe 110 to 150 heatwave days, depending on where you are in that part of the world. So that just basically means, you know, it's almost heading towards half the year being considered part of a heatwave. Now, what is causing that? That's the million-dollar question. Obviously, 2023 was our hottest year on record. There's a lot of influence from global warming. But in that part of the world, there's also lots of changes with land cover change, with what's happening with the Amazon basin, and being so close to the equator as well. The measurements can come up quite differently there. But certainly, I wouldn't have wanted to be in that part of the world last year. It was just absolutely relentless.
Were you able to tease out what comes from El Nino and the ocean heating versus what is just human-caused?
We didn't. So that wasn't the purpose of this study. This study was just to simply report, you know, basically how bad last year was in terms of terrestrial heat waves. But certainly there are components from all of those three. But based on my previous research, anthropogenic climate change or human-induced climate change is by far the biggest driver of heat waves globally. We do tend to see a bit of a boost from El Nino, but funnily enough, that usually happens the year after El Nino happens. So we should, technically speaking, see, you know, more heat this year just because El Nino has already happened. Whether or not that happens this year, it remains to be seen. But it was a little bit of a surprise just how hot last year was. And on top of that, as you mentioned, our oceans were incredibly warm. We didn't even touch on marine heat waves, but they were in a lot of places all over the world. And that would have certainly contributed to the heat waves that we saw on land too. But we haven't yet been able to disentangle the responsibilities of each of those mechanisms.
And what about North America, where many of our listeners are? It seemed like there was unusual heat spreading all the way from Mexico to Alaska in 2023.
Look, it was. Certainly in your high summer, or actually in your July, basically for the whole month, parts of the southern contiguous United States and also up in the northeast around northern Canada and Alaska were quite hot for, you know, a prolonged period. But the heat waves, it was almost like a flickering effect over Northern America. Heat waves were just going on and off all the time. And that was basically from your late spring, well into your fall as well. It was constant. And interestingly, these heat waves were also occurring at exactly the same time as we're having really bad heat waves over Europe. That often doesn't happen. Sometimes it's a bit of we see a push and pull where one continent might be hard hit and the other one less so. But last year, it was literally everywhere all the time, which was, you know, from my perspective, was spectacular, but also extremely concerning.
So I guess it's asking too much when you're doing a large-scale global study to include things like urban heat islands and what actually happened in record places of the city. I mean, like Phoenix, they hit often 48 degrees C. That's 118 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade, but that's measured at the airport. It must have been even hotter downtown. Do you foresee a big study like yours being able to take all of that into account as well?
It's the next frontier, because we know generally that heat waves are changing. They're obviously increasing. Whether we see that in the climate data or our own anecdotal experience, it's happening. The next frontier is understanding what happens at those local changes. How does that urban heat island or changes in land use affect how heat waves manifest. Getting that better precision, particularly over scales at which people live and work, is so incredibly important, but we've barely begun to scratch the surface there. So I certainly see that as a very important development. It's not necessarily something we could have done really until now, just based on our background knowledge and even the resources we have at hand, but it's certainly something we need to focus more on. I talked previously about what was happening in the Amazon basin and the land surface change with deforestation. That's huge for heat waves, and we can see it in the imprint there. So we certainly need to do more research as to what's happening over those scales and how that affects, you know, heat waves at those scales and also more broadly.
So in 2023, as you and your team report, around the Mediterranean, summer heat came in April. What did you find for that April in Europe?
Yeah, so over Europe and also Northern Africa at the beginning of, halfway throughout spring, they had a pretty terrible heat wave. Much of the region was affected with temperatures that were roughly between 3 to 9 degrees Celsius above normal. But some parts of Europe, particularly Portugal, the temperatures were 20 degrees higher than normal. So that's really very, very hot and reminiscent of what you would expect in summer, certainly not in the middle of spring.
And then it got even worse in Europe. Your team says July was the hottest month ever recorded in southern Europe, and that needs about 3 exclamation marks, I think. And I wonder if people even remember, because there's so much coming at us. There's wars, there's AI, there's all these other issues. Once the heat wave's over, we want to forget it, but we really shouldn't. So with repeated heat waves lasting what seems like forever, among the thousands of records set in one year, how did your group decide what to include?
Oh, gosh, that was a hard thing to decide. So, yeah, you're right. Like, Europe in summer, especially in July, was record-breaking heat. They even named a heat wave Cerebrus at that time, and it resulted in massive wildfires in Greece. All the footage of people being evacuated was pretty pretty sobering. So when we came to decide on what heat waves that we'd focus on, we did look at things like, well, what were the impacts? How record-breaking was it? So, you know, going back to the Europe example, it was a record-breaking month, and we had all these people displaced because of the wildfires that these heat waves helped induce. You know, if you think about the South America case, well, they had many heat waves throughout the entire year. And on top of that, they were occurring in winter, which is just, I still can't get over how phenomenal that is. Similarly, as I mentioned, for North America, we did focus on a couple of heat waves more intently, but there was, you know, there was many that flickered on and off throughout the year, so they got a mention too. Not all heat waves could get a mention, but it was basically those, you know, those patterns and those impacts that really stood out to us. And that's really why Australia didn't get mentioned, because there was nothing that really stood out, despite it being just an overall warmer year than average.
Well, could you tell us about Asia? Because that's where the majority of the people live, in India and in China and Indochina. What happened there?
Yeah, that's a really good point. It was yet another one that, you know, I wouldn't say it took us by surprise, but it was phenomenal and record-breaking in its own right. So around about this time of year is actually when parts of Asia, or most of Asia, are more prone to not just heat but humidity just before the monsoon sets in. And last year they had some not only record-breaking heat but record-breaking hot and humid conditions, which is incredibly deadly because your body just simply can't sweat enough to cool down. So they had record-breaking incidences of the heat index, which incorporates those two variables. And so, you know, basically in April, especially for a week in the middle of April, much of Asia, so we're talking from Vietnam, Thailand, all the way up to eastern and even northern China, you know, record that record-breaking heat and in some places the humidity as well. India was also heavily hit. They do tend to see more of these conditions more often at this time of year, but it was certainly impactful there as well.
Well, I don't want to nitpick, but I noticed in the report that you said that we had warmed since pre-industrial times by 1.45 degrees. And then, of course, Copernicus came out and said it was over 1.5 from pre-industrial already, for at least for the last 12 months. But then I realized, well, maybe the Copernicus report came out after you'd already done all your research. But what do you think about this 1.5? Have we crossed this danger boundary? Does it matter that much?
It matters politically, I think, and if we haven't crossed it, we're incredibly close to it. So So that 1.5 degree threshold that you mentioned is just for that 12-month or the last 12-month window. So Copernicus are correct in that statement, but that's just for, you know, 12 months averaged together relative to pre-industrial conditions. There can very well be variability around that potentially in the coming years. And actually Copernicus came out first by saying we had warmed by 1.48 degrees Celsius, but some other agencies said, well, it's probably a little bit less than that. We're right on that precipice of that potentially, or, you know, how it's been framed, is safe level of climate change. Now, I don't believe in safe climate change. It's all pretty bad news. But the fact that that's already starting to happen and that will likely constantly exceed that threshold in the next decade, two decades tops, is really frightening because it's, you know, it symbolises so much. It symbolises that we've failed, at least in part, the Paris Agreement from 9 or 10 years ago. It's pretty sobering, and it just highlights, you know, I guess what we haven't done in that decade, and how much more work we have to do in the next coming decades.
Many Americans are worried about immigration from Latin America, and I look at your report, and it was sizzling in Central America during the period of 2023. And again, when I look at the African heat maps during that period, it just makes me cringe. It was so hot. We have to think eventually that another area of study would carry on from your report to look at, is the migration starting to be driven more by climate change now with these conditions?
Absolutely. Australia, we get a lot of our immigration from Asia, in Southeast Asia. So it's happening everywhere. These sort of countries that have climates that are already very hot and are very humid, and these places are, you know, only going to see more of these record-breaking events more often. It really is quite worrying that, you know, that there could very well be mass migration, and, you know, not too far away as well. It's not my area of expertise to understand how this does affect mass migration, only that I'm certain that it will. But I dare say studies are picking up in this area. And I think because it's just all happening a bit sooner than anyone thought possible, to be honest.
Yes, it is. So what are you working on these days?
I've got a few projects, but my two most central ones, both focusing on heat waves. But the first is focusing on humid heat waves and how they look like in the future. So as I've already discussed, heat and humidity is really important for human health. But it's really not until now that we've been able to understand how those variables combine and what they might look like in the future. And the next study is looking at how heat waves will change once we've reached a net zero carbon emissions, because there seems to be this sort of kind of feeling that once we reach net zero, everything will be better, things will start to, or if they're not already better, they will improve rapidly. But what most people tend to forget is there's already so much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that's going to hang around for hundreds of years, and our climate needs to adjust to that. So I think it's really important to understand how climate extremes, just like heat waves, will change for better or for worse once we have reached those net zero emissions globally.
Dr. Perkins Kirkpatrick is with the Fenner School of Environment and Society, Australia National University, and the ARC Centre of Excellence for 21st Century Weather at ANU. Find links to Sarah, this paper, and our conversation in my weekly show blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. By the way, our local electric grid was down the day of this interview. Landline phones keep working during blackouts, and I used a mixer and other peripherals to record to a handheld recorder, all powered by the 2-hour battery backup funded by Radio EcoShock listeners. Thus, even the powerless continue to speak. Thank you for listening.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Governments and business want to know when weather catastrophes are coming. Yes, current tools of meteorology can predict most of it, but not the fast-moving, most extreme events. There have been many nasty surprises. Part of the problem is it takes time and it's expensive with computer power to test out all the combinations of winds way up high and down low, the pressure systems, everything. Now Google claims it built an AI dedicated to testing for future weather catastrophes. It is called the Scalable Ensemble Envelope Diffusion Sampler, or SEEDS model. The new AI is similar to ChatGPT, but trained on mountains of historical weather data. The new Google tool should reduce computing needs and provide extreme weather warnings for small organizations or businesses or whoever. My concern, this AI operates within the universe of weather records from history. Can it cope with weather extremes no one has ever seen before? That is what we're dealing with now, already in the 2020s, with more to come. I will put a link to the new paper about Google's catastrophe model in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Eventually, maybe with a $100 billion computing center, I might include not just weather, but all the social factors, ongoing wars and pandemics, political division, billion-dollar frauds, in order to predict civilization-wide bottlenecks and downs. Then the billionaires can head to their bunkers in New Zealand. Maybe the same God machine will realize the power is about to go out, so it seeks solar and wind while shutting down fossil fuel burning power stations and the equipment. The thing is, we do not need to wait for AI to solve our problems. With climate, at least, we know what needs to be done. We are not doing it, and instead are furiously making the atmospheric energy imbalance worse. The latest global LNG, that's liquid natural gas, outlook from the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis predicts, quote, tidal wave of new LNG supply to flood market, end quote, just as demand for natural gas is actually falling in key markets. Quote, the IEEFA expects Europe's gas and LNG demand to fall through 2030. Europe's natural gas demand has declined 20% since 2021 due to fuel switching, increased nuclear and renewables generation, and energy efficiency measures. LNG imports to Japan and South Korea fell 8% and 5%, respectively, in 2023, end quote. As the United States becomes the world's largest LNG exporter, with more gas coming online world over, this IEEFA predicts LNG ports now in development could fail. Are we listening, Canada? Fossil fuels are just a bad investment in every way. Could a political, social, artificial intelligence manipulate public thinking into a real transition? Do we want a machine using our own psychology to get climate action? Of course, algorithms and deep learning machines are already at work night and day on stock exchanges, on social media, and in the labs for medicines and weapons, in corporate planning, in military. How bad would it have to be? How hot and starving? Before humans beg intelligent machines to save us from ourselves. While all that develops, a team of super intelligent humans mapped out Earth risks and possible responses. The climate crisis is now well underway. That is according to a group of well-known scientists. Their big picture overview was just published in a paper titled Earth at Risk, An Urgent Call to End the Age of Destruction and Forge a Just and Sustainable Future. Is it really that bad? Is there any way out of a hothouse disaster? From the School of Ocean and Earth Science and Technology, University of Hawaii at Manoa, we've reached scientist and interim dean Dr. Charles Fletcher, often known as Chip. He is co-author of the April 2024 paper in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. From Hawaii, Charles Fletcher, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be with you.
Your new paper begins saying the climate crisis is now well underway. Can we say that now scientifically?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, we could have said it 40 years ago. The release of greenhouse gas when we burn coal, oil, and natural gas, principally in the form of carbon dioxide, has been proven since the 19th century as a scientific process that traps thermal infrared radiation, in other words, heat, that comes off of Earth's surface after it's been warmed by the sun. There's no doubt whatsoever about this. And by trapping this heat, which would otherwise escape to space, we warm Earth's surface above what it would be without this effect, this greenhouse effect. And in fact, if we didn't have a natural version of this greenhouse effect, Earth's surface temperature on average would be below freezing, and life as we know it wouldn't exist. What we've done by releasing additional greenhouse gases beyond those that are in the atmosphere naturally is to promote this warming, to increase it in what's known as the anthropogenic greenhouse effect. And we have now warmed Earth's surface temperature of the atmosphere about 1.5 degrees Celsius, warmer than the pre-industrial period roughly 2 centuries ago. Now, 1.5 degrees Celsius may not seem like very much. It's a little over 2 degrees Fahrenheit. But in many areas, it's leading to observable shifts and changes in natural processes. For instance, we are melting the world's cryosphere. We are melting Greenland. That fresh water coming off of Greenland is floating on the surface of the North Atlantic Ocean on a major current that is part of a global ocean circulation system that carries heat around the world. Fresh water melting off of Antarctica is in the South Atlantic. And by warming the air, we are also moving that heat into the surface ocean around the world, causing it to thermally expand, creating sea level rise. So we have shifted global scale ocean circulation patterns. We are driving global scale sea level rise. I can tell you that the Northern Hemisphere jet stream has become unstable. It has slowed and developed large meanders, which bring slow-moving deadly heat waves up into the temperate latitudes, and also bring slow-moving deadly cold snaps, known as the Arctic vortex, down into the temperate latitudes, leading to record-setting cold temperatures and record-setting warm temperatures in locations that damage food production, that lead to human health issues. And that's just the beginning of the global scale damage that we see, all with roughly 2 degrees Fahrenheit of warming. And we are on track to hit 3 degrees Celsius or over 4 degrees Fahrenheit of warming. The danger associated with that is very significant, and scientists are deeply worried about this.
Well, as Canadian author Leslie A. Davidson said, we are not lost. We are going in the wrong direction. How is the energy transition going, and what happens if the fossil fuel civilization continues to expand as now?
Yeah, I like that quote. We are not lost, but we are going in the wrong direction. And our paper takes a similar attitude. It's not a doom and gloom paper, and we state that in the opening paragraphs. We just are focused on calling attention to these problems. Now, it's not just about climate change, though, and the paper makes it very clear that we actually are faced with 5 different global emergencies. Climate change is one of them, but also pollution, disease, biodiversity loss, and social inequality. And all 5 of these interact and overlap with each other. They tend to amplify their effects mutually. For instance, climate change has driven poorly resourced communities, lower income communities, deeper into poverty, and disease is expanding. We have dozens of new pandemic level diseases over the last 50 years as we have destroyed forests, especially rainforests around the world, but also we are thawing out tundra, releasing pathogens that were in equilibrium with the deep natural environment and had not moved into human communities. So we need to get a grip on all 5 of these emergencies. And yes, climate change is especially featured in the paper. To correct this problem, we need to amplify our efforts at reducing our dependence on fossil fuels. There are several steps that we recommend, one of which is that we engage in rapid and legitimate decarbonization and correct market distortions that favor fossil fuels. There are many government subsidies for fossil fuel companies that